Basically, I think today in our short slot, this is basically going to be a bridge between yesterday and tomorrow. That yesterday we laid out some of the major issues from a Lumdisha perspective about the question of the original takana of where the Ner Chanukah should be, the current practice, how exactly they relate to each other. So maybe today we'll just discuss a little bit more about that and talk about some of the issues that come up in terms of the practical question of where to light. And we'll probably set the stage for the highly controversial question of yeshiva students, which I think we'll get to a little bit more in detail tomorrow. One of the reasons to discuss it tomorrow is because also there are some additional makoros that are probably worth seeing before we talk about it in any depth, which Brunetta, I will send you out for tomorrow. And so hopefully what we'd like to do tomorrow is get that subject finished and the subject of lighting in shul, which is a pretty significant post-Gemara topic. We'll try to get all that addressed tomorrow. So today, just to kind of bridge the topics, talk a little bit more about the concept that we discussed yesterday, and lay out some of the details, la halacha, and what we'll see is that there's a lot of controversial points, la halacha, nowadays. A lot of it was established yesterday. But Gemara has a lot of different ideals about where the Chanukah candle should be lit. And what exactly continues to apply nowadays, what is a relevant factor, and what about the fact that many of us live in situations where we have all kinds of complicated calculations. So there's basically a trade-off in terms of different factors. So I'd like to just highlight what some of the factors are and talk about how some of those factors are traded off. Maybe we'll look at one brief discussion about it, see how much we can get a little bit of an insight into the cheshbonos that go in to where we light nowadays. So first, just to also to address a question that was mentioned during Seder and something we briefly mentioned yesterday, and just to say a little bit more about it. So we started off saying that the whole notion of sakana, that the Gemara says that because of the sakana, so they instituted a change in policy. So we saw that there was a machlokis rishonim what the sakana was. And the question could be asked, and I think it was touched upon yesterday, it was definitely brought up during Seder, is that you could look at it from a couple different perspectives. That on the one hand, you had the Ritzvah's perspective that we spent some time on yesterday that says, well, obviously, sakana, forget the whole thing. So what's the chiddush of the Gemara? Which leads him to say that there's a lower threshold of sakana that's being talked about here. But there are others who could raise the question from the other perspective, that what kind of sakana are we talking about? Are we talking about a sakana of shmad, where there is a pressure from the non-Jewish government to specifically not perform the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah, which Tosfos sounds like at least later on in Daf Mem Hei? And if that's the case, so then maybe it's not so clear that you should be off the hook. Maybe we should have a policy of Yehari Gal Yavor. Because the Gemara Maseches Sanhedrin and Daf Ayin Dalet Amud Aleph has the basic principle of Yeharig V'Yavor, which tells us normally the rule is Yavor V'Al Yeharig, that if we're under pressure, if we're forced to do an Aveira or sacrifice our lives, so Yavor, we should do the Aveira and we shouldn't get killed, V'Chaybehem, etc., etc., we have an obligation of Pikuach Nefesh. But the Gemara says that there are three exceptions, what's known colloquially as the Big Three, right, of Arizara, Gilirayas, and Shvichas Damim, so that the din is Yeharig V'Al Yavor. And then the Gemara also says that if it's Bifarhasya or Sasha Shmad, which seem to be related concepts, that if it's something that's happening in public and there is a intentional external pressure in order to subvert Judaism, so then that enters into a different category, and that becomes Yarek V'Yavor. And the Gemara gives a phrase there, Afilu Arkas D'Masana, which is a question what exactly that means, but it sounds like it means a very small minute can even rise to the level of Yehari V'Yavor under those circumstances. So then the question deserves to be asked, so then why should that not be applied here? Shouldn't we say that if that's the kind of shakana we're talking about, so then maybe there should be Yehari V'Yavor? So there's a discussion about this. You can look at HebrewBooks.org. There's a sefer called Divrei Sofer, and was written by one of the descendants of the distinguished Sofer family. So the Tshuvas Divrei Sofrim, in Siman Nun Tes, he has a smallish, in between average size Tshuva about this topic, where he notes that if you're going to say, like Rashi, maybe it's easier to understand. Because if Rashi says that it was something that they just didn't want fire, it wasn't necessarily targeted at the Jewish religion per se, but it happened to overlap with Ner Chanukah, so then we have an easier time seeing that as not the kind of Shmad that we're talking about. You know, for example, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, you know, the Gemara raises the question of if we say that when it comes to an Aveira b'farhesia, so it should be Yehari v'yavur, so then why don't we say that Esther, for example, so she intermarried, she married Ahasuerus to save the lives of the Jewish people, but why don't we say it was an Aveira in public, so Yehari v'yavur. So the Gemara has two answers, but one of the answers the Gemara gives is Hanas Atzman, that the point being that Ahasuerus was not interested in subverting Judaism. He was interested in marrying her. So he wasn't trying to make a public display about how, look, all the Jews don't keep the mitzvahs anymore. He's looking just to accomplish his own personal goals, which are not connected to any religious oppression. So therefore, if that's the case, the Gemara seems to say that's not Yehari V'yavor. In other words, it would have to be that the public Aveira is targeted intentionally to undermine Judaism. So if that's not happening, then it's not necessarily the case. So then you can say, all right, so Rashi's interpretation, the Sakana, isn't focused on mitzvot specifically or Ner Chanukah specifically. So then, all right, you could hear it. Or if you say, like the others say, there's some kind of general Sakana. It's interesting, in some of the sources you even find Leitzim invoked, which is also interesting. Right? If you want to say that, it's one thing if you want to take the Ritva's lower standard of Sakana, that's one thing, but to say Leitzim, we're worried about Leitzanis, that's the first Siman of Shulchan Aruch, right? The first Siman of Shulchan Aruch is that we shouldn't worry about people who make fun of us, right? That if we're fulfilling mitzvos and people are bullying us about it, it's not a physical danger, let's say, but they're making fun of us, so the first Siman of Shulchan Aruch, it says we're not supposed to worry about that. So it's interesting why that should be a cheshbon. I thought maybe the only angle I could think of in terms of that is that here the mitzvah is persume nisa, so it's all about that it's being appreciated the right way. So if it comes across to the public as a joke, if it seems like they can't understand why you're lighting outside and you're not going to accomplish anything because of that, maybe that's the, or they'll undermine publicly your persume nisa. Maybe that's the nature of the concern. Maybe it wouldn't be true by mitzvahs in general, but maybe it's uniquely vulnerable when it's a persume nisa consideration. Maybe. But in terms of this point about should it be Yavor v'al yehareg v'al Yavor instead of Yavor v'al yehareg, so the Divrei Sofrim writes that he thinks according to Tosis' interpretation it's a problem. Why don't we say that they're directly targeting the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah, so why don't we say that that's something that should be subject to this rule? So he notes that the Ramah does seem to paskin that we don't necessarily apply this rule to a mitzvah saseh. But if it's a positive mitzvah, we don't necessarily say this, and it's based on Iran. And it's also going to maybe be extended even to, in general, we talk about chilukim between positive mitzvahs and negative mitzvahs. So we don't always know whether we're talking about classification or behavior. We're talking about something that's classified as a mitzvah saseh, or even if it's a lo saseh, but it's violated by sheval tasa, it's violated passively, maybe that should be included as well. So here you find that the Ramah says that by a mitzvah saseh we don't have this din. And others explain this is true even by a lo saseh that would be violated passively, just by omission. So it's interesting. What's the svara for that? Why should it make a difference if we can say that it doesn't matter how chomer or how kal it is? Right? That if we're going to say that if it's a question of severity, right, so then we sometimes find that los aseis are considered to be more chumer than aseis. So all right, so you'll say los aseis are a big deal, mitzvah aseis are less of a big deal. But here we find that if the Gemara says that even in very small issues, everything becomes yavor, yehareg val yavor when it's in public, so then what difference does it make, big or small? So it doesn't seem to be an issue of big or small. So what is the reason to distinguish between aseis and los aseis? So the Ran mentions one reason. I think you mentioned another reason as well. Anyone want to take a stab at it? What possible distinction might there be? Brian?
Maybe like an inherent misser.
Is that true, though? Is that true that you're saying that a los aseh is bad, and aseh doesn't involve anything bad, just a lack of goodness? And therefore you can't have bad. Maybe. I think we need to maybe solidify it a little bit more. Any other possible theories? So what the Ran mentions is the whole point of your martyrdom here, let's say if somebody tells you to do an Avera and you're going to put up a fight, so then the hope is you'll avoid doing the Avera. But if somebody's going to force you to not do a mitzvah saseh, so they have the power to stop you from doing that. They could either kill you or they could put you in jail and keep you away from the mitzvah. So it's not necessarily in your control to make sure you do the mitzvah. So if all of your self-sacrifice is not going to accomplish anything because they could stop you from doing the mitzvah anyway, so then there's a tzad to say there's no point. That maybe it's only true when you could make a difference. And indeed, you could also make the case, as some do, that if it's even an active lo saseh, but somehow they're going to be able to make you do it anyway, so then maybe there isn't a point in Mesiras Nefesh for that. It's all about avoiding the Avera, and in this case, you can't necessarily avoid the Bitul Aseh because it's in their power to force you to be Mevatel the Aseh. Hi.
On top of that, you know, it's in their power to force you Mevatel the Aseh, you're also unable to perform other mitzvahs in the future. Does that make a difference?
Well, so that's the whole question of, in general, Pikuach Nefesh Docha Sakal, right? The Gemara has different makaros for why it is that Pikuach Nefesh overwhelms other mitzvahs. In one place, the Gemara quotes the drasha of V'chai Behem V'loshia Musu Behem, but then the Gemara also quotes the idea of Chalel of Shabbos Achas, so the general svar seems to be that you'll be able to have a much more involved religious life if you stay alive and you go to look to the future mitzvahs, you live again to fight another day, to accomplish mitzvahs another day. So that seems to be the general svara of Yavor V'Aliyeh Harik. So the Chiddush that we sometimes say Harik Val Yavor already seems to outweigh that svara. So it's hard to say that it would necessarily play a role when we already have a din of Yehari Val Yavor. But I think another factor which is particularly relevant to some of the sugyas we're talking about here, and it's going to come up this week in Parsha Shir, stay tuned for some synergy in Parsha and some things we've been talking about, is that if the whole issue here, especially when we switch from the big three to the Farhesya, right? So when you have the big three, so the big three, to borrow a phrase from Ephraim, so those are objective averos, right? Those are inherent averos. So you could say that don't do them no matter what. But when it comes to the Farhesya Shmad category, so clearly the Avera is being given its power because of the Farhesya quality, because the fact that something is happening publicly. So then the question becomes again, is it possible to publicly not do something? Right? The fact that you're not lighting Neres Hanukkah, is that any kind of a public statement? Our whole concern is that your Avera, even if it's a minor one, will be turned into a public undermining of Judaism. So is it possible to make a public statement undermining the Torah passively? So it's a question we've touched upon in the past about can you make a statement by not doing something, as we mentioned by Rashi's idea that not using the candles would be some type of a hecker. We had a hard time with that. And again, stay tuned for Thursday. It'll come up again in the Parsha. So here the question could be as well, that maybe when it comes to a mitzvah saseh, that it's not shaykh to make a statement through not doing something, and therefore you shouldn't necessarily have a din of yihari val yavor, even if it is a shas hashmad, and they specifically targeted this mitzvah, perhaps. You could say differently, you could say the fact that nobody's going to do this because they targeted the mitzvah will show a defeat for Judaism, you could definitely hear such a svar, but maybe a general reluctance to apply this concept to a mitzvah saseh may also emerge from something. So then, just to go back to the rest of the points that we discussed, so we talked about the general question of whether the takana has basically changed nowadays. Do we say that originally there was a takana to light outside, and that may or may not include the possibility of lighting inside? Something changed, which was either a new takana replacing the old takana, or it was just a fallback on an option within the old takana. That was two possibilities we discussed yesterday. And then the question becomes also, so what happens nowadays if we assume there's no takana anymore? So do we revert to the original situation, or do we say, like, for example, the Dvar Yehoshua said that no, Chasimus HaTalmud ended with change in circumstances, and that's what we're stuck with, and so therefore we stick with lighting inside. So we mentioned yesterday Brisker Rav, I don't know if it's in his original Ksav, it's quoted in different places. I saw quoted in his student Rav Tertzin Sefer. It's a little bit differently than we say what we said yesterday, so just wanted to revisit that. The way Rav Tertzin quotes him is that the Brisker Rav said that it essentially is a new takana that replaced the old takana. So that means b'shas ha-sakana, when it actually is a time of danger, that even if you had an individual who is not in danger, so then he also still lights inside. And he explains that based on the idea of it being a new takana, but he also mentions a svara which is relevant to sakana issues in general. We mentioned this when we're talking about lighting on airplanes, that the whole nature of a sakana issue is that it has to apply across the board. You can't have an individual say, well, listen, it's a sakana for everyone to do this, but I could pull it off safely doing it by myself, because if everyone does it, it's going to be a sakana. So we therefore assert something from a sakana perspective, even on the individual level. So when this takana is in place, so then even an individual who could possibly light without sakana, if in his area everyone doing it would be a sakana, so then the sakana applies to everyone and everyone is able to light inside. However, after the time of the sakana, the Brisker Rav seemed to understand that it goes back to lighting outside. And he did apparently rule that if one, for whatever reason, isn't able to light outside and lights inside, so then he's not fully in fulfillment of the mitzvah and he has to relight later. So he gave an example there that apparently happened to him, that it was very windy outside at one point, and he therefore lit inside because it wasn't viable to light outside. But then when the wind calmed down, so then he relit outside, apparently assuming that there is a still takana to light outside when possible, which isn't fulfilled when lighting inside. Now, it still means that if you have no options, let's say again, it's America, like the Aruch HaShulchan described, and there's a blizzard outside, it's simply not shayach, so he would still presumably assume that's an onus which allows you to light inside. But if it would clear up, and if you have the opportunity to light outside, which, let's say in America, would not be feasible at all, but in Eretz Yisrael is a different story, so then the Brisker Rav would presumably say to light again outside. So I think we had questions. This through. Okay, revoked. Okay, wow. Well, yeah.
So wait, I don't understand. Is he saying there is a mitzvah to light inside if you can't light outside? Normally, if there's
apparently both. You know, because he would still assume that, because the scenario, just the case that was given of what happened with him, was that he lit it inside because it was too windy outside.
So, but so apparently, there's no one is preventing you from doing a mitzvah. You have to do it in a different way.
Oh, so this is unique, right? So this apparently still holds on to that type of Ikra Takana, that there was this institution of Sakana includes onus situations, apparently. So if you can't do anything else, we still let you do that. But now that it's possible to do lighting outside, then the Brisker Rav assumes you do have to light outside, and that you don't fulfill that lighting outside fee by lighting inside. So if it's possible to light outside, you'll have to light outside, even if you're already lit inside. So, new approach. And again, when we saw the Dvar Yeshua said differently, said he doesn't think that we have any ability to light outside anymore, that there was, and he brought a proof from the Or Zeruah, the fact that the Or Zeruah was questioning why people in his door lit inside anymore if there wasn't a sakana anymore. So apparently what you infer from there is that he thought the logic didn't apply, but yet it was still done, and he didn't feel powerless, he felt powerless to do anything about it, so he takes that as a raya that the Or Zeruah didn't do anything about it, we can't do anything about it, it's considered to be done. Hi.
So, I mean, I guess you can make it a broader question than this concept, but so how would you approach this according to both the Achrona and the Brisker Rav and the Bar Yeshua?
Mm-hmm.
So you're not Yotze according to the other one, so what do you...
Right, so that's a machlokas. Yeah, it's not an unheard of level of machlokas that we find. Mutually exclusive machlokas is not
one,
so
no
unheard
of. No one suggests that you should like both.
I'm sure there are those who would like both.
So how come in America today, if it's not blizzarding out, it's November Hanukkah, that people don't all of a sudden...
Right, because most people don't agree with that, Brisker Rav. You know, that's certainly not the widespread... As we mentioned yesterday, that Binyamin Yeshua Zilber writes in his Shuvas that even in Eretz Yisrael, it's a minority meaning that has developed. It is not the... I think the... And you find support for this in the earlier sources, as pointed out, that seems to be the case, that once it was known to do this way, they continued it that way. As it's clearly a tradition, as all the Sfarim that discussed this point out, of great Gedolim who have not deviated from that path ever since the time of the Gemara. So clearly the majority of the world feels that you still light inside. The question is, why? Is it a minig? Is it understandable somehow? I mentioned a couple of approaches yesterday, but it's clearly the vast majority view that we stick with that practice. Another interesting question, I saw this suggested in the Sefer. I'm not sure if it's necessarily proven in that Sefer, but it's an interesting question to consider, that when we spent some time a few weeks ago talking about the question of whether Neres Chanukah is a Chovas HaBayis or a Chovas HaGavra, is it addressed specifically to the household or to the individual? And there is a suggestion that was made, which may make sense, that you could say that it changed. That if it was originally supposed to be lit outside, so maybe that was a Chovas HaBayis. But once it shifted from being outside and now it's inside, so maybe it's no longer a Chovas HaBayis, and maybe it's a Chovas HaGavra, even though we still have the halacha of Ner Yishu Beiso. So maybe that means that it's the kind of Chovas HaGavra that one person can fulfill on behalf of the household. They can all be Yotze with a Balabayis, but maybe the whole nature shifted. It used to be a household obligation, and now it's a Chovas HaGavra with whatever nafkaminas that may possibly have. So that's a suggestion as well. So just to mention, the few minutes we have, some of the calculations that come up, halacha l'maisa, and we'll get into those big topics tomorrow. So we see the Gemara has said a couple of things, right? The Gemara seems to say, ideally, you're going to light outside. And worst case scenario, you'll light on your table, and that'll be enough. In the middle, the Gemara says, Yom hayadar ba'aliyah menicha b'chalon asmucha l'rishus harabim. If you live on an upper floor, you should put it in a window that is facing Rosh HaRabbim. So the Gemara also mentions that there's a preference to light less than 10 tefachim high, because that'll also give something a hecker, because it's an unusual place to put a candle. And also the idea of lighting with a surrounding situation where you have your mezuzah on your right and your Hanukkah candles on your left, so you're surrounded by mitzvos. A bunch of different priorities that I mentioned in the Gemara in terms of place. That's the Gemara on top of Chavez and Medalev. I have Shmuel Midifti, I'm Mishmol. Duchas Mishmol, Gadesh, and Yerchanik, and Mishmol, and Mizizim, and Yamin. So how do you add up all these parts today? Nowadays, if you find yourself having to calculate what the priority is, what do you do? So just to mention, I think we put on the Mar Makomos the Magen Avram. The Magen Avram assumes that nowadays the most likely ideal place is going to be a window. Right? So if you have a window, so then that might be best, which also factors into why some posts can understand that nowadays we light inside. Because if we light inside nowadays, but we also do it by the window, so then maybe since that's kind of mentioned in between, it's not clear that may also be L'chadchila. So if we light inside, but we light by the window, so maybe we're accomplishing more than lighting outside nowadays. So maybe we're fulfilling what might be the current din of lighting inside. We're accomplishing for B'nai Beiso as well, if that is the ikur nowadays. And you're also making it public by lighting in the window. So many assume, like this Magen Avraham, but some also question and say, well, it depends. And the Prichadash raises the question, are we talking about a window that's higher than 20 amos? Now that'll also complicate things. In the time of the Gemara, it says in Darba Aliyah, so that probably means you have a two-story house, right? And the tradition was in those times that you had a two-story house, there was one family in the bottom part and one family in the top. So a two-story house is less than 20 amos high. Because let's say if you say 20 amos is somewhere between 30 and 40 feet, so one story nowadays is about 10 feet, so you could get up to three or four stories before you exceed 20 amos. So it could be the Gemara is talking about somebody who lives on an upper level that's within what would translate nowadays to three or four stories. If somebody is higher than four stories, so then the question becomes, okay, so then maybe that's not Kedai, no one's going to look up that high, and therefore maybe it's better to light by his door. Maybe at least there'll be Pesach Beiso. Maybe that will at least accomplish something. Hi.
If you live in a basement.
If you live in a basement, so then also if it's too low, so then people are also not going to look down there. You may also, unless you have a window that's by the street, which sometimes basements do. And then you may also be able to accomplish less than 10 tefachim. So if you have a window that just peers out into the street level, that might be better.
Hi. Since we're talking about the mm-hmm. What happens if
apartment complex, you know, like a lot of people are in a situation where you can't light it next to the door because it's a fire hazard.
Right. So then you could do by your window. Do you have room by your window? So the window might be in there, but they could also do. Right, but also part of the calculus will be, you see everything here is a little bit of a trade-off, part of the calculus will be how high is the window, and what options do you have. So what you find in Shuvah is you find a lot of this weighing back and forth. So then some say, well, if you're ready up in an upper level, so maybe it's better to light by your door, because the Gemara says that if you light by your door, so you're surrounded by mitzvos in terms of having the mezuzah on the right and the menorah on the left. So Moshe Feinstein has a truth about this, where he says that this whole idea of being surrounded by mitzvos, says that's not really a very compelling reason. Says that's what he calls it a tam kolosh, meaning it's a weak reason. This is not really something that's very powerful and compelling as far as the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah goes. He says that really this is together with the idea of lighting by the doorway in the time of the Ikar Takana. So you're already lighting in the doorway because of Persume Nisa. So once you're already standing over there, so then it's also nice to be surrounded by mitzvos, so arrange things this way. But he thinks this would never be strong enough to outweigh the Persume Nisa of something else. So if you have a window, nowadays, in a modern context, you have a window that's visible in the street, so the window is certainly going to be much more public than in your doorway surrounded by mitzvos. So the idea of being surrounded by mitzvos is a weak svar, as he puts it. It's a tam kolosh, which only was after the fact, together with the Persume Nisa. And he says it would never occur to us that it should outweigh a real Persume Nisa, and any such consideration would take a greater priority. So I think Amir was up first.
Yeah, I don't want to get too specific, but what if you're not next to the street?
Right, so then that also becomes... I brought in one brief discussion to see if we can quickly look at it. Just to give you an example,
yeah.
Maybe we won't read inside in the interest of time, but Rav Asher Weiss, it's a one-page thing, so I brought it in case we had time to look at it together. Maybe I'll give it out just to give an example of how complicated these things get. So he talks about a whole building complex where you have one house after another in a circle, and I guess each house is behind the other. So, and then the Rosh HaRavim is at the gate of all the four houses. So you kind of enter into a path where I guess we have kind of a circle away from the Rosh HaRavim. So every house is looking at the back of the other house. So that's a complicated question. So what's best? You do your window, which is facing the street, but the street is only in the back of the other guy's house where he's not going to look. So it's an interesting math situation that basically every scenario you're going to have, you're going to try to figure out what's going to be the most Persume Nisa together with the established categories that the Gemara has and what's something that's relevant to these categories. So for the Sefer Chaim B'Chag, which is written by Rav Gutman, Talmud Chacham from Satmar, who's a friend of Rabbi Simon's, so he suggests that the whole consideration that some of the poskim writes, let's say in terms of when the Magen Avraham says to light by the window, so the Pri Chadash and Pri Megadim say, what if it's too high? What if you have an opportunity to light lower than 10 tefachim? Is that a bigger advantage? So he suggests, he says, that whole thing only applied Bisman HaGemara, the idea of less than 10 tefachim, because people used candles and oil to see. So you need something to differentiate that the menorah is an unusual light. So if you put it on the floor, if you put it low down, so then it'll be differentiated. Says, but nowadays, everyone uses electricity for their light. So everyone will understand already the fact that you're lighting candles is already unusual. So we don't need to put it lower to make it unusual. So that factor will get kicked out. So it's again, you see the way these different factors are weighed. So here Moshe was saying the idea of being surrounded by mitzvahs was only significant in the time when that was together with a Persume Nisa of outside. It wouldn't outweigh anything that's a Persume Nisa qualification. And here Rav Gutman is writing that in terms of the idea of lighting lower than 10 tefachim, that's also not nogeya nowadays, because it doesn't add anything nowadays that doesn't there already by having a menorah. Steve, any question?
If you're in a basement, you might have less than 10 tefachim off the ground. Is it better light there or not light there?
So then you may have that added advantage, because your window can still be visible by the street, and you'll have the technical words of the Gemara, which presumably even that previous sheet that we're just mentioning would agree with. He's just saying that in your house, it's not better if you're trying to decide whether to light by your window on a normal floor people will see outside, or light low down, because the Gemara talks about lighting low down. It says the whole idea of lighting low down is to make it recognizable. And nowadays, you're using electric lights anyway, so the whole concept of the menorah is already recognizable, so that quality doesn't play a role anymore.
But if you have a basement window where it's like really mamish at the third level, and you have one of those smaller menorahs, so the Gemara says that it's less than 3 tefachim, you're not yotze at all, so that's already dangerous, no?
That's already dangerous to be yotze that way.
If you're less than
3 tefachim is very low. I'm seeing the window is so.
If you're on the dirt line,
right, and they can't see it at all.
It's possible.
Yeah. Okay. That could be. You have to see if there's any variables there also. But I hear where you're coming from.
I mean, this question not being yotze is obviously not
a because you still have the household.
Yeah.
Right. So the end. Right, and even they say nowadays it's the whole point of the household anyway. So then you at least have that. So as long as you have the people in the household. Hi.
Is there a spot in the Gemara anywhere that talks about apartment complexes or high-risers being part of the collective? Like, so if you have one menorah in front of the apartment, they're part of a collective establishment.
Right, so very much so. Let's quickly introduce that point, and then we'll see. We still want to get those major points discussed tomorrow, so hopefully we'll get everything done. We want this to be a one-week sugya. But just to address that point briefly, so we see already in the Gemara, that there's a concept of a chatzer. And it's, you have this outer area, and it's not 100% clear when it says to light outside. It's a little bit of a machlokas rishonim. Should you light outside your door or outside the door of the chatzer? So you should be aware that there is a very often cited position of the Chazon Ish, which also, I don't know if it's in the Chazon Ish itself, it's quoted in Svarim such as the Hanagas of the Chazon Ish, and Reb Chaim Kanievsky quotes it in the Shona Halachas. It's very widely quoted in the name of the Chazon Ish. And it affects Hanukkah, but it also affects other areas of halacha as well. It comes up in Hilchos Erevin, and it comes up in Hilchos Mezuzah. And the Chazon Ish maintain that there's a fundamental difference between a chatzer, as described in the Gemara, and what we might think of a chatzer in a modern-day apartment complex or building complex. That it used to be that there were these courtyards outside the houses, but they were kind of a common space where people did things. They actually functioned, they shared that space with other families who had houses in the area, but it was still actually a place of usage. And that nowadays, the chatzer, let's say the lobby of our apartment buildings, or maybe it's an outdoor courtyard in terms of you have some houses surrounding it, there, that's really just there for decoration, it's there for aesthetic purposes, it's there as a passageway, but it's not actually used. So Chazon Ish thought there was a fundamental difference in terms of all these areas of halacha. So for example, he also makes a reference in Hilchos Nezikin, there's a concept of Hezek Re'iyah, that if somebody can see into your chatzer, somebody can see into your house, is building a construction where they'll be able to see into your house. So then the person who lives in the house that's now going to be visible has some rights to say, you can't do this, you're spying on me. So it extends also to a B'nai HaChatzer, if people can see into the courtyard, so then everyone who lives in the courtyard has some rights as well. So the Chazon Ish says that's because there used to be a whole different kind of a courtyard. People used to do private things in the courtyard. Okay, so they had a few neighbors who knew about it, but they didn't want to be spied on by people outside. But nowadays, the Chatzer is not used in that way, and that a lot of these Talmudic applications would not necessarily apply to a contemporary Chatzer. So that's one way to look at it.
So
Rav Asher Weiss, I mentioned him again in his Sefer Minchas Asher, so he takes issue with this application because he says the Maaseh, at least for the purposes of Chanukah, if the point is that it should be visible so people pass through, so why should we say that our modern day chatzeres are any different? Maybe it does make sense to say that a chatzer that we have does suffice for this purpose and it is a good public place to put something in. So he tends towards that personally as his opinion, but he says it must be that the Chazon Ish, his svara is that it has to have a status of beso and a status of being connected to you, and that it was only in the time of the Gemara that there was usage in this area that it becomes kind of connected to your house. But now that it's just kind of a space in between where you live and the street, that doesn't become connected to you in that sense, or it doesn't become your bias in that sense, and that seems to be the Chazon Ish's problem, that maybe it loses its status as your house for that purpose. But the logic is there also, and part of the complicated calculus that you see in the poskim on this issue, and we'll discuss tomorrow a little bit more about this, we're just about out of time, but the question of is there also a requirement, as you see from Rashi's comment over here, that maybe there is an idea that the candle should not just exist and that you put it there, but that it has to have some kind of shaychus to you, that it has to have some kind of connection. So if you have, let's say, a joint type of apartment building or something like that, so maybe we're missing any type of connection to the person, maybe it has to be placed in some way that it maintains some type of connection to the person putting it there. So let's say, for example, some of the Sfarim write that numbers might be enough. So if you had a two-building house, a two-family house like they had in the time of the Gemara, so then you had two menorahs there by the opening. So we'll know, okay, there are two families, two menorahs, it corresponds to the two families. But you have an apartment building which has dozens of apartments and nobody can connect anything to anything. So then maybe that changes. So again, you see, everything is a complicated cheshbon of how all these factors add up, and that's why you do get some very differing opinions as to how the math works out, which factors still count nowadays, which factors don't count. And that gets us to the verge of tomorrow's big issues, the question of dormitories and settings like that, and other types of public lightings like we find in shuls, and how that came about. So Be'ez Hashem, we'll pick up with that tomorrow, and everyone should have a wonderful day. All right, stay warm.